أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد. ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المذلومين، واللعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه وهو أصدق القائلين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: فأقم وجهك للدين حنيفا، فطرة الله التي فطر الناس عليها، لا تبديل لخلق الله، ذلك الدين القيم ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون. صلوات على محمد. Tonight is the third night of Muharram 1433 AH, as well as our third majlis. And our subject is freeing the butterfly within. And what we have been saying is that insan has two distinct natures. There is one nature which is an animal instinct within the human being that serves the human body. Its purpose is to seek pleasure, to flee from pain, and to survive. That in me which is fearful of death, that in me which fights for survival, for life in this world, that in me which seeks food and occupies me with the search of earning and purchasing and preparing and eating, that in me which seeks a mate so that I may reproduce of my own species, that is all related to this instinct within me that is called tabi'a. Then within me there is also a nature that is divine. There is something in me, a natural disposition that is hardwired in me, that wants to worship a higher being, a higher power, that asks questions related to justice, to freedom, to equity, that cannot tolerate injustice or ignorance. That is my fitrah, which is unique to human beings. Fitratullahi lati fatara an-nasa alayh. That natural disposition that is in human beings. لا تبديل لخلق الله. You cannot alter this nature in insan. You can hide it, you can deny it, but it is hardwired. You can find justification for it, but it cannot be removed. So while discussing the characteristics and the differences between tabi'a and fitra last night, we gave two analogies. In one analogy we said fitra is like an intelligent being, a rider on a mount. Tabi'a is the mount itself. It's like a wild horse that can be running wild, or it can be tamed and reined in by fitra and controlled by it. The other analogy we gave was that of a gushing river, a force that has tremendous potential but is untapped and that flows freely, but it can be regulated and controlled and made useful with a dam, a barrier that holds it and regulates it, and that is my fitrah. What we wish to do tonight, first and foremost, is to talk about what do we mean when we say human nature or something as being natural. We use this term all the time when we talk. We say it's human nature to do this, 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 or this is natural to all human beings. It is important to talk about this and try and categorize these things in two separate boxes. Which of these things that we call natural is tabi'i, and which of these is fitri? Let's take some examples. If I was to see someone suffering, it is natural that I will feel pain within me. The same young man, the same young woman who asks and who attests to this and says that when I see someone suffering, I feel pain and it is human nature to do so. That same young person says that when I'm walking in a shopping mall and I see a beautiful woman, I want to look at her. Is it not natural? Is it not human nature to want that? Why does Islam tell me lower your gaze? Is it not natural for a woman to want to show off her beauty to others? Why does Islam tell her, no, don't show your beauty, put hijab? Is it not unnatural? When I see good food, I want to eat it and I want lots of it. Is that not human nature? Why does Islam keep telling us to do things that are unnatural? Here, when we ask such questions, there are three issues that we need to keep in mind. The first and foremost is that we are obviously confusing tabi'a and fitra. Many of these issues that we talk about are tabi'i. They are nature that we share with animals and other species on this planet. Remember our discussion of being in an alien body and surviving this plane of existence. Talk to psychologists, talk to doctors, talk to even the people who don't believe in God. When they talk to you about the laws of attraction, they will tell you that all these things that we do, quote-unquote, naturally, this is simply chemistry or biology taking place within your body. It happens to us, it happens to animals. For example, in many animals, in many mammals, it is known for a fact that unlike human beings who attract each other and mate and reproduce throughout the year, animals have certain times of the year in which they reproduce. They have a mating season. And within these animals, there are some mammals that is known about, and possibly in all our creatures, that when their mating season arrives, the female of the species will do certain things to make herself more attractive to the male species. And the male species will then fight amongst each other. And the female will choose the one who wins that fight. Why? Because they say it is natural for all species to want to reproduce their own kind, but not just their own kind. They want to reproduce creatures that are healthy, that are strong, that are beautiful. So they are instinctively, by tabi'a, they will look for a mate that is strong, that is healthy, and in their perception, beautiful. And humans in that sense are no different. These are not my words, this is not even something from an Islamic source. This is general, you talk to scientists, to doctors, they will tell you this. There are studies that have been done by psychologists who sit in places like shopping malls and observe you and I when we are interacting with others. They say that when a young man is walking in a mall and he sees a group of girls, instinctively, he will suck his stomach in, he will take his chest out, he will flex his muscles, and he will walk differently past them. Without knowing. Is that fitra? No. That is tabi'ah. That is chemistry. That is biology. When a girl sees a man who she thinks is attractive, instinctively she will start flirting, she will bat her eyelids, she will talk softly, she will be a damsel in distress so that he can rescue and be the knight in shining armor for her. But by doing so, she is seeking a mate, and so is he. This, they say, is chemistry, this is biology. So this is the first thing, that we should not confuse fitra and tabi'ah, that when we see such behavior, it does not mean that we are opposing that which is natural from Allah. That may simply be a characteristic of our physical body while we live in this plane of existence. That is one thing. The other thing is, let us not forget the ego. We have spoken about the human ego at length when we discussed the end of negative suffering, and we said that because the mind produced this illusory self out of conflict, and it has a very limited scope and believes that it can only solve its problems by acquiring more pleasure and fleeing from physical pain, it assumes this to be the solution to all problems without realizing that the more it seeks pleasure excessively and with an obsession, the more it creates suffering for itself. So the ego, using this tabi'ah within the human being, does not know that if I keep looking at this non-mahram again and again, it will not solve any problem. It will just increase my suffering or my frustration. But the ego thinks this is an immediate solution to my problem. So it seeks, it believes that if I have more food, if I have more physical pleasure, then I will be happy, that I will be free from pain. It is incapable of seeing that this is a vicious cycle that does not end. Because it is not the function of tabi'a or the ego to understand where true peace comes from to a human being. And we will talk about what is it that can really give human being peace when we talk about fitrah in the coming nights, inshallah. So this is the other thing, that we must not forget the role that ego plays this. The third thing is that even if we suppose that these tendencies that we call as quote-unquote natural, why does Islam put restrictions and say hijab and lower your gaze and don't do this and don't eat too much, and even if these things are natural to me, just because they are natural does not mean they're good. There are many things we do that are unnatural, but we do them because we believe there is some goodness in them. Simple examples would be, for example, wearing clothes. Yes, wearing clothes to cover our nakedness, to cover our private parts, that is fitri. Why? Because even before Allah talks about Adam being sent down, when Adam and Hawa eat from that forbidden tree, and Allah, قُلْنَا بِتُوا, we talked about this, where Allah says, go down to this plane of existence. Before that, when you read the Quran, you find that as soon as they ate from the tree, and they became aware of their own selves, they began looking for leaves and branches of trees and began hiding their nakedness. So that is fitri. It is against your fitrah to roam naked, even if people tell you it is natural. But over and above that, the other clothing that we wear is not as such natural, but we do it for other reasons. We do it because of the weather, for example, to protect ourselves from the cold, or we do it to make ourselves look attractive to others. Part of our clothing is the shoes we wear. Is wearing shoes natural? No, it's not. Today, shoes have evolved. I'm sure if you look at the history of shoes, it would be a very fascinating history. But essentially, when human beings began wearing shoes, it was a piece of leather under the feet with a cord tied at the ankle or at the toes, right? Is it natural to walk around with a piece of leather under your feet? No. But you do that to protect your feet, because it is harming you if you don't do that. We brush our teeth every morning and every evening. It's not natural. If it was natural, we'd come out of the wombs of our mothers holding a toothbrush. Right? It's not natural. We go to the washroom to relieve ourselves. That's not natural. Natural is what babies do. That's why we put diapers on them. But we train ourselves an unnatural behavior where we hold ourselves until we have access to a washroom, and then we use that. This is unnatural, isn't it? So just because something is quote-unquote natural to my instinctive animal self does not mean it is good. Sometimes I need to train myself to do something unnatural, because therein lies goodness for my health and for society. And you can extend such examples. When we want to show affection to each other, we shake hands, or we hug, depending on the relationship, or we kiss. Is that natural? Shaking hands is not natural. Think about it. What do you do when you shake hands? This is my physical body, an alien body that I reside in for a limited time. Attached to this body is a limb, my hand. You have a limb attached to you. You bring your limb, I take my limb. We clasp and then we do this. Supposing you saw two, I don't know, lions or crocodiles or gorillas doing that, you would say, I wonder what they're doing. But we do that. If it was natural, our children would know this themselves, but they don't. From the time they are 2 and 3 years old, we take them, when we bring them before elders, when we bring them before grandparents, when we bring them before others, we say, shake hands, hat do, right? Kiss grandfather, huggy, kiss, we teach them. Why? It is not natural, but we teach them from a young age that as a species, these are the things we do to show affection to each other. In that same manner, the way you as a parent teach your children to do things that are not natural because they need those skills in order to survive in this plane of existence. Fitra wants to teach tabi'ah certain things even if it sees it as unnatural, because it is needed for the development of the soul and for its perfection so that it can reside in Jannah in the Akhirah. So just because something is tabi'i does not mean it is good. Fitrah will decide if it is good. Tabi'ah, remember, does not have this ability to judge whether something is just or unjust, righteous or unrighteous, good or bad. For tabi'ah to make that judgment would be like for your ears to judge if something is red or green. We talked about this yesterday. Tabi'ah is just an animal instinct. It just wants pleasure. It wants every woman it sees. It wants every food it sees. It doesn't know halal and haram. It doesn't know whether this is usurped or not usurped. Fitrah will reign it. Fitrah is the rider. Fitrah will say, no, you have come here for a purpose to develop your soul. You need to lower your gaze when you see a non-mahram. And because this fitrah comes from Allah, fitratullahi allati fatara an-nasa alayha, Allah's laws and commands will tell us how to rein in this fitrah and what things fitrah thinks is natural, but it has to be trained, even if it doesn't understand. You may have never questioned why you shake hands until today, perhaps. You were trained to do so when you were 2 years old. In the same way, your tabi'ah will not question if your fitrah trains it from the right time. And that is why this verse of Quran that we have been using as a theme from Surah Ar-Rum, فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا, set yourselves on this pure religion, which is based on the natural disposition, the fitrah that Allah has wired into human beings, and there is no alteration to this fitrah, but most people do not know. This verse of chapter 30, verse 30, there is a verse before it. If you go and read chapter 30, verse 29, Allah says, بَلِ اتَّبَعَ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَهْوَاءَهُمْ بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ. But those who are unjust, they follow their desires and their lust without knowledge. After saying that, meaning those who are unjust, they follow their tabi'ah without any boundaries, without any rules, without any regulation, they give in to every temptation. After that, he says, you be different. فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا. You set yourselves on this deen of fitrah, not on a life of tabi'ah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Now, one of the things that I had intended to do tonight as well, actually last night, then we ran out of time, was to, because we have been giving this analogy of going from a tabi'i state to a fitri state as being so radical that when you become completely a fitri or fitra oriented or fitra driven human being, the change is so radical. We have been giving an analogy. It is like the metamorphosis of a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. And what I would have loved to do was to actually talk to you how a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. At first I thought this might not go well, because people may say, well, now we're getting a science lesson from the mimbar. Then I thought, in Nahjul Balagha, Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he actually has an entire sermon where he talks about the bat and describes the bat. He has another sermon where he talks about the peacock. So it wouldn't be in any way against that. However, I have a lot of material to cover. I may not even be able to complete that. So I'm not going to actually go through all that. But I would encourage those of you who are interested and who want to see this analogy and why we chose this subject, freeing the butterfly within, when you have some chance, Google this, how a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. There's even videos of these on YouTube where you can actually see that process. It is an absolutely fascinating process. And as you look at this, try and bring parallels to the human development, particularly the spiritual development. How, for example, a caterpillar, when it is first hatched and born, within the first 2-3 weeks, it will just eat continuously until its mass multiplies thousands of times. And that's exactly how human beings are completely tabi'i driven from their time they're born. And then how, when it is ready to change into a butterfly, it will attach to itself to a tree and give out its final exoskeleton. Moths do the same thing, by the way, but moths, their outer shell from which they emerge is called a cocoon. For caterpillars, for butterflies, the more technical term is it's called a chrysalis or a pupa, in which they shed this exoskeleton that surrounds them, and they disappear from the world for a time. Just like a man who seeks God will sometimes be amongst people but disappear from the world. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He describes such people and says, their bodies are with you in this world, but their spirits are high above in the heavens. And the scientists will tell you this, that on the outside it looks like it's just a cocoon or the chrysalis, but inside there is tremendous change. That caterpillar is chemically being deconstructed and then reconstructed again. The most amazing thing is that some of them, the chrysalis will break apart and the wings open up, and that is an amazing thing to see. Okay, that process, for some it will happen in 5 to 7 days. For some, it will happen in a few weeks. For some, it will take 8 to 10 months. For some, they will hibernate throughout winter and hatch the next year. In this is a lesson for us as well. Some of us will go from tabi'a to fitra in an instant. Some of us will need weeks. Some of us will need years. Some of us only at death, and some of us will even need the hereafter to become this butterfly. So we never lose hope in anyone, but this is a fascinating world that we need to look at. We acknowledge this in our understanding of religion. How many times have you heard that not every person who dies will be raised on the day of judgment in human form? We've heard this time and time again. What does it mean, my dear brothers and sisters? It means that outwardly here we have been given an alien body, that's why we all look the same. But in reality, each one of us in this room is pregnant with a soul. And the choices we make in life between tabi'a and fitra, our souls are developing. They are becoming something. They are trying to become butterflies. When we die, we give birth to that which is within us. And the idea is that you are pregnant with a soul. When your body falls apart, that is just your cocoon, that is just your chrysalis, that is not the real you. The real you will emerge after death. So some evolve now and some do not. Now let's talk about enlightenment. How does this enlightenment, this sudden change to fitra, come when it comes? A lot of times this will come in an instant because of a calamity in our lives. We struggle throughout life concerned about our spiritual well-being and how we can be more spiritual. We try to keep this fitra alive within us. And then something happens, one incident in life, a miracle we witness or a calamity befalls us, and that becomes a trigger, that becomes the spark because of which we suddenly gain this enlightenment. There is a sudden shattering of the ego, there is a certain growing of the wings, there is a certain metamorphosis that takes place. The closer we come to enlightenment, the harder it becomes for us as well. Keep that in mind, because the ego has been with us since infancy. It is resisting change. It does not want to die. That is why many mystics have reported that when they are closest to enlightenment, they undergo severe depression. And we will talk about addictions, attachments, and depression in the coming nights, inshallah. There is a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He says, expect relief at the tightening of the chains. When the chains tighten the most, that is when you should expect relief. فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. With hardship comes ease. No, with hardship comes ease. Allah knows your capacity, so sometimes you are squeezed with a calamity. And then there is a certain relaxation, you're left, and then again you're squeezed, and then you're left. Your capacity is being tested. If you can withstand, and the squeezing continues and you do not give up, it will shatter the ego. What will emerge then will be that beautiful butterfly. But we need to have that capacity to withstand, to have that faith with us while this happens. An analogy I like to give about going from tabi'a to fitra, or going from being egoically driven to being enlightened, is that proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. That light at the end of the tunnel is that enlightenment we seek, that fitra we seek. However, to see that light, first and foremost, you must be willing to stand at the mouth of the tunnel. When you stand at the mouth of the tunnel, there is a dark passage you must cross. Tabi'a is afraid of darkness. It is afraid of everything. Tabi'a will say, don't go. We don't know what danger lurks. Turn and flee. Most people will turn and flee. The rare few who will have the courage to walk through that dark tunnel, which may be represented as depression or any other calamity, they will emerge on the other side and stand in that light. Once they have crossed that tunnel, they will not know any fear. They will never come back. But even if they did, they have transcended the fear. You see, death itself is not as fearful as the fear of death. And we will talk about this again very shortly. The most frightening human experience is the shattering of the ego. A lot of us are afraid when we die, the pain we will feel. Don't worry about the physical pain. You could be in a hospital dying, and they could give you drugs, you will not feel any physical pain, right? You hear of this all the time. People are in a coma, they get morphine, they die. It's not the physical pain. What is really afraid of death is not your real self, because your real self knows you are eternal, you will never die. What is really afraid of dying is the ego, that false sense of I that was created. That I is afraid of even being diminished. When you insult me, my ego is diminished. It is deflated. That is threatening. That is a sign that I might die. So to reinflate, it takes a backlash. It will insult you back. It will fight back. It will go back and backbite about you. Right? It will send a nasty email to you. Why? Because it needs to reinflate to regain its original sense of I-ness. But at death, because the body falls apart and the brain falls apart and the mind falls apart, therefore that sense of I-ness that was created by the mind must also go. It was an illusion. And that feeling of I am losing my sense of I-ness, I am ceasing to exist, is the most frightening thing. It is a feeling like I'm going mad, I'm losing my mind. That is what we fear the most. We have a choice. We can seek spirituality and allow that to happen with our own volition, or we can continue denying and pretending death does not exist, and then at the time of death it is taken from us by force, and that makes it more frightening. The same it is with whether we choose to be tabi'a oriented or fitra oriented. We can choose to become butterflies so that when we die we are happy to be freed from this cage and to soar to new heights. Or we can remain in our cocoons in fear and refuse to change. And then when we die, we realize we have always been a caterpillar and always stay in a caterpillar. And now because we have no wings to fly, we can only be burnt by the sun and perish in that manner. So we have said that once you cross this tunnel, you do not come back and you overcome the fear of death. It is the same as saying once you become a butterfly, there is no going back to becoming a caterpillar. Now, let us give an example from the Quran of how this happens when a person changes from tabi'a to fitra, how they overcome this fear of death completely in an amazing way. And this will be our final discussion before we come to a conclusion for tonight. The story and the example we take from the Quran is from the story of the Prophet Moses or Musa alayhi salam. Fir'aun or the Pharaoh is a complete representation of total tabi'a. When Allah wants to speak of oppressors, of tyranny in the Quran, He uses Fir'aun as the absolute embodiment of this dhulm. Okay? Or of a taghut, He uses Fir'aun. When Musa comes back to Egypt with his brother Harun alayhi salam, Fir'aun sees the miracles he brings, so he challenges him. He says, let us have a showdown. And because he is so confident, he says, we will not do it now. He sets a day. And he invites people from all over the country to say, come and witness how we defeat this Musa. He does not realize he's setting himself up for his own defeat. Then he has people sent out through his domain, and he looks for the most accomplished magicians, the best of them, and they come to him. Now, these magicians, as we all know, they repent. When they first come, they are tabi'ah driven, just like you and I. But there is something in them. They have kept their fitrah alive, even though they continue with tabi'ah, even though they commit a major sin, which is the practice of witchcraft and magic. Now, we go to Surah Ash-Shu'ara, which is chapter 26, verse 41. فَلَمَّا جَاءَ السَّحَرَةُ قَالُوا لِفِرْعَوْنَ أَإِنَّا لَنَا لَأَجْرٌ إِن كُنَّا نَحْنُ الْغَالِبُونَ. When the magicians came for this showdown, they said to Fir'aun. Now Fir'aun was a god to the people. He had said to them, "Ana rabbukum al-a'la," I am your exalted lord. So they are talking to God now. They said to Fir'aun, "Is there any reward for us if we should overcome Musa this day?" And Fir'aun knows that they are tabi'i driven. People who are tabi'i driven are greedy. They want rewards. They are reward seekers. So he feeds into this reward. Verse 42. قَالَ نَعَمْ وَإِنَّكُمْ إِذًا لَمِنَ الْمُقَرَّبُونَ. He said, "Indeed, indeed. Not only shall you have a reward, but you shall be amongst those who are closest to me. You shall be the elite. You shall be the مُقَرَّبُونَ." So now there is the reward, and then there is the prestige. There is the status. You are the closest to God. We continue with Surah Ash-Shu'ara, chapter 26. Now we skip verse 43, we come to verse 44. فَأَلْقَوْا حِبَالَهُمْ وَعِسِيَّهُمْ وَقَالُوا بِعِزَّةِ فِرْعَوْنَ إِنَّا لَنَحْنُ الْغَالِبُونَ. So they threw their ropes and their sticks on the ground, and so confident they swore in the name of their Lord. They said, بِعِزَّةِ فِرْعَوْنَ, by the might of the Pharaoh, we this day shall be the victors. Now in Surah Ash-Shu'ara, of course, the story of the serpent of Moses swallowing all their magic is given. The same thing is given in Surah Al-A'raf in chapter 7, verse 120 to 122, that when they saw that Musa had something that was real and theirs was magic, they played tricks on the eyes of people. The people saw the sticks and the ropes moving like snakes, but they knew this was just hypnosis. But they knew what Musa had was not magic, it was real. Now, وَأُلْقِيَ السَّحَرَةُ سَاجِدِينَ. Surah Al-A'raf, chapter 7, verse 120 to 120. وَأُلْقِيَ السَّحَرَةُ سَاجِدِينَ. The magicians fell down into prostration. قَالُوا آمَنَّا بِرَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. They said, "We submit and believe in the Lord of the universe." And then to make sure people didn't think this Lord was the Pharaoh, they said, رَبِّ مُوسَى وَهَارُونَ. The Lord of Moses and Aaron. Is this normal? That someone who has been a magician all his life, who looks up to the Pharaoh as God, who worships him, who has been promised reward and status, he just sees one miracle and he changes 180 degrees. He now falls into prostration and is now saying, "I don't believe he's God. I believe in the Lord of Musa." What we learn from here is that when enlightenment comes, it comes instantaneously. The ego believes, "I need time to be enlightened." Because the ego can only live in the past or the future. The ego believes, "One day I will read all the books in my library and become enlightened." Because that is future. It enjoys thinking about the future. The present is painful. The ego believes, "One day I will memorize the whole Quran. One day I will become such a person that I will fast all day and pray all night. One day." Because that is future. Whereas the true self is screaming, "Not one day, today, today, now, now. Today say La ilaha illallah. Give up your desires and your tabi'ah today. Surrender today. Why? When I go for ziyarah, then I will start wearing hijab. When I go for hajj, then I will start praying salat." No. If you wish enlightenment, you don't need time. Time is an illusion itself. And this itself is proof. They instantly change. Now look at how a tyrant behaves. We will talk inshallah about governments that are tyrannical and how they are tabi'ah driven. But Pharaoh symbolizing tyranny, we come back to Surah Ash-Shu'ara, chapter 26, verse 49 to verse 51. Now he's embarrassed because he's lost. And his magicians, who are his front line, they have given up on him. And he had gathered this massive rally for people to see Musa being defeated. So he needs a face saver. He needs to change the subject. قَالَ آمَنْتُ لَهُ قَبْلَ أَنْ آذَنَ لَكُمْ. The Pharaoh now says to the magicians, you dare to believe in him before I give you permission? إِنَّهُ لَكَبِيرُكُمْ كَبِيرُكُمُ الَّذِي عَلَّمَكُمُ السِّحْرَ. I know what happened. This Moses is your chief. He is the one who taught you this magic. You guys planned this together. فَلَسَوْفَ تَعْلَمُونَ. Now you will see what I do to you. Now that is a threat. That is the kind of threat in its minuscule form, the kind of threat you give your children. Huh? When they embarrass you in public or in the mosque, you hiss at them and say, just you wait till we get home, you will see what I do to you. And by the way, when you threaten your children and beat them, they will do the same to you when you grow old. Because they are learning from you that this is acceptable, that when you are stronger and you have somebody who's weaker, you can oppress them to control them. So when they are stronger, they will control you in the same manner. فَلَسَوْفَ تَعْلَمُونَ. Now you will see what I do to you. لَأُقَطِّعَنَّ أَيْدِيَكُمْ وَأَرْجُلَكُمْ مِنْ خِلَافٍ وَلَأُصَلِّبَنَّكُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ. I will amputate your hands and your legs from opposite sides. I will cut, no anesthesia, I will cut your right hand and your left leg. Just chop it off. And then why will I leave the other hand and the other leg? Because then I will crucify all of you. So when I peg you there, I need something to put those pegs on, right? I need the props there. So I will chop your hand and your leg and then leave the other and I will crucify you. لَأُصَلِّبَنَّكُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ. This is not a small threat. Fir'aun was known for his torture techniques. The Quran in another place calls him Dhul Autad, the man of pegs, because of how he used to peg people and crucify them. You see, it's easy for me to say, for you to listen. But when somebody who is a tyrant threatens you, if you have lived in a country that is ruled by an oppressor, it is very different. Ask our brothers from Iraq what it was like living under the rule of Saddam. They will tell you. There are many today in Iraq who speak even against the existing government because they know they have that freedom to speak. The same individuals would not have spoken during the time of Saddam, because of the fear he had imposed on people's hearts. Even you and I, today, let us just take a hypothetical example. You go for a holiday, you go for ziyarah, you go to Pakistan, you go to Afghanistan, God forbid, you get kidnapped by Taliban, Al-Qaeda. They put you in a room. You, Shia, you will see what I do to you. And then they bring the electric saw and they bring the surgical knives and they bring the pliers and they say, we're going to pull your nails out and we're going to peel your skin off and we're going to pour hot oil on it and we're going to burn you and we're going to drill your eyes. And when you're faced with that kind of fear, you will do anything they say, won't you? If they tell you, curse Imam Ali, you might to save your life. Why? Because tabi'a needs to survive. It will fight for survival. It is afraid. It does not have courage. Courage, overcoming fear of death, is a quality of fitrah. Unless you have become a completely fitrah individual, appreciate the martyrs of Karbala through this. It is not easy to stand before a tyrant. It takes someone like Zainab alayhi salam or the fourth Imam alayhi salam to stand in front of Yazid or to stand in front of Ibn Ziyad and say to them on their face, you are a liar. My brother won this battle, not you. Right? So this is now, look at these magicians. We're going to come to a conclusion. When Fir'aun threatens them in this manner, I will cut your hands and leg from opposite sides. I will crucify you. And they know what he is capable of. Same Surah Al-Shu'ara, verse 50. What do they say? قَالُوا لَا ضَيْرْ إِنَّا إِلَىٰ رَبِّنَا مُنْقَلِبُونَ. They said, we don't care. There's no harm. Why? We are returning to our Lord now. You can only control our physical body. You cannot do anything beyond that. Not only have they overcome the fear of death, they have overcome the fear of torture. They do not know the meaning of fear. They have crossed that tunnel. They know what the difference is between the pain and the fear of the pain. إِنَّا نَطْمَعُ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لَنَا رَبُّنَا خَطَايَانَا أَنْ كُنَّا أَوَّلَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. We are hopeful that our Lord will forgive us because we were the first to believe. From this we see that when enlightenment comes, it comes instantaneously. From this we see that when we are driven by tabi'a, our priority is greed and status and prestige. We want people to praise us. We want people to reward us. We want acknowledgement from other than God. We want the pleasure of people. But when there is fitra, then we want only Allah's pleasure. And from this we understand that one who is driven by fitra has no fear of death and no fear of torture. If you can recite the salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. We stop here for tonight. I think this is enough for tonight. We will continue from this inshallah, still talking about tabi'ah and fitra. We will begin talking now tomorrow inshallah that why do we still need tabi'ah, and how does tabi'ah and fitra complement each other, and how do they attempt to oppose each other. And by doing so, we hope to know more of ourselves and our nature so that we can always choose fitra. We want courage, we have to choose fitra. We want to overcome the fear of death, we have to choose fitra over tabi'ah. Until that moment of enlightenment when suddenly we make a choice and there is a shattering of the ego and we completely transform from this caterpillar to butterfly and we become this being of fitra as opposed to a being that is driven simply by animal instinct and tabi'ah. If you can recite another salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Tonight is the third night of Muharram al-Haram. And tonight we want to pay our respects to an individual who was with people that were tabi'ah driven. And because of his purity of heart, he had that instantaneous change on the day of Ashura and completely transformed from being a creature driven by tabi'ah to being a creature driven by fitra. And this individual is Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. How great was Hur's courage? If Hur did not have that fitra that could not bear to hear little children crying, Al-Atash, Al-Atash, today Hur would not have been Hur alayhi salam. Today, our 12th Imam alayhi salam would not be sending salam on Hur. Understand the maqam of Hur. Would we have done what Hur had done? Last night was the second night of Muharram. And we said, Aba Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam arrived in Karbala on the second night of Muharram. I will come to Hur again. But I should also mention that when he came to Karbala, unlike the forces of Yazid, Hussein alayhi salam wanted to show us the value of amana as well, of being faithful and not usurping the rights and properties of others. He asked, whose land is this? They were told it belongs to the Banu Asad. He said, bring me the people to whom this land belongs. When they came, he said, I wish to purchase this land from you. They said, Yabna Rasulillah, you do not need to purchase, you are our guest. He said, no, we will be buried here, I want to purchase this land. He bought the land from them. Then he gave the money back to them. O Banu Asad, I give you the money back, but in exchange for a favor. What is it you want, Yabna Zahra? He said, look, when we have been killed, there will be no one to bury us. I want that you should come out, though you do not have the courage to come and fight with me. Come and bury our bodies when you see them lying under the hot sun. But Hussein could see the future. He said to the Banu Asad, I wish to speak to your women now. The women of Banu Asad came. He said, oh women of Banu Asad, if your men are afraid of Ibn Ziyad and they refuse to bury us, when you go and take water from Furat, then bury our bodies. Then Hussein said, I wish to speak to your children now. He spoke to the children of Banu Asad. O children of Banu Asad, if your fathers and mothers do not bury us, when you go out and play in the wilderness and you see our bodies on the sands of Karbala, take handfuls of sand and cover our bodies. That is why when Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam went to Medina, and one day he heard a man on the street saying, Anal Ghareeb, Anal Ghareeb, the Imam came to him and said, if you die, are you concerned who will bury you and give you a shroud? He said, no, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, I am amongst Muslims, why will no one bury me? He said, don't call yourself Ghareeb. Ghareeb was my father in Karbala. Tonight, my dear brothers and sisters, is the third of Muharram. When Hussein was stopped by Hur on the outskirts of Kufa, he said to Hur, I will go to Kufa. Hur put his hands on the reins of Hussein's horse and said, oh Hussein, I cannot let you go to Kufa. To which Hussein said, oh Hur, may your mother weep for you. Now look at what saved Hur. I personally believe what saved Hur was Fatima alayhi salam. It is Hur's respect for the daughter of the Prophet that is what saved Hur. Hur says to Imam Hussein, Aba Abdullah, if your mother had been anyone other than Fatima, I would have said the same thing to you. But what can I say when she is the daughter of my Prophet? Hussein came to Karbala. The day of Ashura came. The morning of Ashura, before the battle began, a man says, I saw Hur pacing up and down, restless. I came to him and said, oh Hur, if anyone would say to me, who is the bravest commander in your army, I would have mentioned your name. This is a small army of only 72 people. Why do I see such fear on your face? He said to the man, come with me, come with me. I want you to listen to something. He brought him closer to the khayam of Hussein. He said, listen, do you hear anything in the air? The man began to listen. He said, yes, I can hear young children crying, Al-Atash, Al-Atash. Hur said, this is what disturbs me. أُخَيِّرُ نَفْسِي بَيْنَ الْجَنَّةِ وَالنَّارِ I find myself choosing between paradise and hell. But Hur could not withstand the cries of the children. He took his brother with him. He took his son with him. He took his servant with him. He began heading towards the khayam of Hussein. Hussein has been waiting for this final shaheed. Hussein says to his brother Abbas, Abbas, we have a guest coming from the other side. Hur says to his servant, tie my hands, blindfold me. I am ashamed to see Aba Abdullah. When Hur comes to Imam, he throws himself at his feet. Aba Abdullah, I am the one who stopped you from returning to Medina. Aba Abdullah, I am the sinner who stopped you from going to Kufa. Aba Abdullah, it is I who put my hands on the reins of your horse. Is there any way you will forgive me? This is the house of the Ahlul Bayt. This is Kareem ibn al-Kareem. Hussein lifted Hur. He untied the ropes from his hand. He hugged him. Oh Hur, you are our mihman. Hur, you are our guest. The books of Maqtal say that when Hur had repented to Hussein, and when he had reassured himself that his Mawla and Aqa had forgiven him, I have read this riwayah myself. Hur said to Hussein, oh Hussein, give me permission to go and speak to the women folk in your house. Hussein said, oh Hur, go and speak to them. Hussein came to the tents where Zainab and Umm Kulthum were. Hussein stood outside and said, As-salamu alaykunna ya ahl baytin nubuwa. It is I, Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. I am the one who is the cause of your misfortunes. Your children are crying, Al-Atash, Al-Atash, because of I. Hussein has forgiven me. Will you forgive me as well? The women began weeping from inside. Some of the women called out and said, oh Hur, go, we have forgiven you. This riwayah continues. It says, now look at the ihtiram that Hur has for Sayyida Fatima. This is why he was saved, and she will reward him indeed till the end. Hur then says to Zainab and the women of the Ahlul Bayt, he says, O women of the Ahlul Bayt, I wish to take one more promise from you. Promise that you will not complain to Fatima about me on the Day of Judgment. I will not leave until you promise you will not complain to Fatima about me.
the women assured him, "Oh, Hur, we will not complain to you, to Zahra. When Hur was satisfied that Fatima is pleased with me, he returned to Hussein and said, "Oh, Hussein, I was the one who brought you this misfortune. Let me be the first one to sacrifice my life." Hussein allowed Hur to go. "Hur, you are our mihman. We do not have even water to serve you." Hur went and fought. His son went and fought. His servant and brother went and fought. When Hur fell from the horse and called out, "Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah," Hussein ran to the battlefield to receive his shaheed. Hussein took the head of Hur and placed it on his lap. Hur was covered in blood and sand. Hussein wiped the sand and blood from the face of Hur. Hussein began to say to Hur, "Ma akhta'at ummuka idh sammaytaka Hur." "Oh Hur, your mother did not make a mistake when she named you Hur. Anta hurrun fid dunya wal akhirah." "Oh Hur, you are free in this world and the hereafter." Then Hussein took out a handkerchief and said, "Oh Hur, this is the rumal of Fatima." Hur was bleeding from the forehead. Hussein tied the handkerchief of Fatima. "I would say, oh Hur, who needs Jannah when you have got the rumal of Fatima? Oh Hur, at least you have the rumal of Fatima. Zainab will not even have the rida of Fatima after this year. Oh Hur, how fortunate you are." Before Hur went to the battlefield, he sent his son. "Look at Hussein Karim ibn al-Karim." Hussein sat with Hur because he knows Hur will not bear the loss of a son. When Hur's son fell from the horse and called his father saying, "Ya Abata Adrikni," instinctively Hur stood up and ran to the battlefield. Hussein ran after him and held him back. "Hur, do not go to the body of your son. Hur, it is not for a father to lift the body of his young son. Hur, you will not be able to do this. Let me go and bring your son, O Hur. I would ask, O Aba Abdullah, who will hold you back when Akbar falls? O Aba Abdullah, I know who will hold you when Akbar falls." The Rawi says, then when Ali ibn Akbar fell, and Hussein stood to run to his son Ali, as he ran saying, "Ya Ali, Ya Ali," Hussein kept falling on the sands of Karbala. He kept standing and sitting and tripping on the sand of Karbala. It is as if the sands of Karbala were holding the feet of Hussein. "Mawla, do not go to the body of your son. It is not for a father to lift the body of a son." Wa Husayna, wa Madluma, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.